Hey lovelies, before we get started, I wanted to remind you of all the different ways you can get your hands on one of my designs. Impact Fashion is a line of size-inclusive modest clothing available in sizes 2 through 28. I personally design and pattern every single piece in the collection so that it is fitted to perfection and every single piece runs the same. That means that once you know your size, that is your size in every single piece in the collection. Pretty cool, no? You could shop the collection online at impactfashionnyc.com. Shipping is totally free in the U.S., and the return policy is, if I do say so myself, better than Amazon. You have 30 days to make a decision and don't even have to pay return shipping or any sort of annoying restocking fee. Impact Fashion can also be found at the address at American Dream Mall. The address is a curated, modest department store and definitely worth a visit if you are not an online shopping type of person. The American Dream Mall is located right next to the Meadowlands Sports Complex in New Jersey, and to get to the address, you're going to want to park in Lot C, Level 3. Make a left when you walk in, and you'll see the address on your right. I'm always happy to chat, whether that's to answer your sizing questions or just get to know each other better. Find me on Instagram and TikTok at impact.fashion.nyc or on WhatsApp status at 516-953-9391. You can also email me. It's Rivky, R-I-V-K-Y, at impactfashionnyc.com. Enjoy the show. From Impact Fashion, it's Be Impactful, a show about the women making a difference in their own corners of the world. I'm Rivky Itzquiz, and on today's show, I sit down with a prolific cookbook author to talk about her newest book for Pesach. She shares why she felt the need to make a Pesach cookbook, how her own restrictive customs growing up shaped her view on this type of cooking, and the changes she's seen in the kosher food blogging industry over the past 12 years. Miriam Pascal Cohn is the reason my family eats most nights. Heck, she's the reason I eat most of the time. I am constantly and consistently reaching for her books and blog for the real life recipes that I know everyone will eat and enjoy. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of becoming her friend, and I knew we had to sit down and chat for this newest release. Hello, Miriam. How you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for having me.
It is so wonderful to have you back on the show. And this is for purely selfish reasons, because the amount of excitement that I have over your new cookbook is out of this world. Literally, I had it on the family chat when you first announced Real Life Pesach Cooking. I was like, guys, Miriam's coming out with another book and we're set. We don't have to worry about Pesach. Mind you, the only year I made Pesach was during COVID. So this like doesn't really even affect my life that much, but we're all very, very excited about it. And it's a big deal. Tell me a little bit.
Four.
I know.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's also.
I can't believe I've written four cookbooks.
You can't believe it. How you did it. Of course you should believe it. It happened. Like you were there more than anybody else. And this is also, this has a special place in my heart because your last cookbook, More Real Life Kosher Cooking, was when we first met.
Yes.
That was when we first met. I reached out to you about the launch party. And I was like, hey, if you need any help with clothes, I'm happy to be there. And we have become such wonderful friends.
Beautiful dress.
Oh, that was such a good piece in the collection. The royal blue jacket dress. It's a great. Yeah, I know you still wear it. It's a good piece. You should be still wearing it.
Actually, when we got married, am I getting like too sidetracked too quick?
I'm good with sidetracks. Go. What were you going to say?
So when my husband and I got married, I had like all black clothing, and I wore that dress like at my in-laws, and everybody was like, "Ooh, remember color."
Miriam knows how to wear color. Go figure. Oh, that's so good. Tell me about why you wanted to make a Pesach cookbook. Why did that feel like that was what should be your fourth book? Because like, I'll be honest, I will take more real life kosher cooking. Like I'll do it. So why was Pesach the next thing you wanted to tackle?
That's a very good question. So I actually write about this in my intro, and you know, I worked with Naomi Nachman very closely on her Pesach cookbook, Perfect for Pesach. And I photographed the book and I tasted much of the food and I helped her troubleshoot some recipes. And there are a couple of my recipes in the book. And it was, you know, a really interesting experience to hear from her and to learn from her. And Naomi loves Pesach food. And I was like, oh, I don't love Pesach food. Like, I could never do this because I don't love Pesach food. And I think that's why I had to write the book, because the truth is, at this point, I love Pesach food also, but not in the way Naomi does. It's not like I hear Pesach and I get excited, like, ooh, I can't wait to cook for Pesach. My perspective on Pesach food changed, and I'll talk about that in a minute. You know, the reason I call my books Real Life, and everything, my Instagram and my social media, my website, everything I do is really all about real life. And I think the biggest element of real life that I can share with my readers at this point is to say, you don't have to love Pesach cooking and get like light up with excitement when you hear Pesach cooking. You can enjoy it, you can succeed at it, even if it's not like your thing, like it wasn't my thing. And in fact, I write this in the intro, but I'll tell this little maybe embarrassing story, but I wrote an intro of my book, so we can share it here too. The first year that I was writing Pesach recipes for a magazine. So just to briefly tell you my story, in case you don't know or don't remember, I started my blog in August 2011, and right around January 2012, I got my first magazine writing gig, and maybe February. So I wrote they had me write recipes for perm first, which was really easy for me. Even back then, I've had such a good sense of like when a recipe doesn't work, like what the problem is that I can fix and why it didn't work, and I can, you know, troubleshoot it really easily and get it right. So with the perm recipes, it was like so smooth. And then they're like, okay, Pesach recipes. And I was like, uh-oh.
I don't know how those
Like,
work.
I don't know. Like, you know, I always made a couple basic things, and I was like, I don't know how to create a Pesach recipe. And I worked so hard, and I was trying. I had this idea. I have to remember what it was. It was something with carrots. I don't remember if I was trying to make cookies or cake, or I
With
later made
carrots?
amazing carrot. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I thought it would give like bulk with it. I don't know. And you have to also remember this was the days before almond flour.
Right before there were as many, like, this is when all Pesach cake was made with potato starch.
So I was like, I was working so hard and I didn't know what to do. And I like it was not coming out, and after batch, and I was just like, I remember sitting at the table, like looking at like trays of failed food in front of me, and I was just like crying, and I was like, I can't do this. I don't have it in me. Like, there's no way. And I think it's pretty crazy that that was 12 years ago, that now I'm coming out with a Pesach cookbook with many amazing, amazing Pesach desserts. You know, Pesach non-desserts are easier for me, although there are limitations. But Pesach desserts were so hard, and it took. And then the next year, I remember saying, "How about?" Because at that point, I was only doing desserts for the magazine. So the next year, I remember saying, "Like, how about I take a break from desserts and do real food?" And over the years, I learned, and I think I put a lot of that, like the struggles and the failure and the hard stuff. I put that into the book, and I kind of, you know, all my books, I call them real life kosher cooking, real life, more real life kosher cooking. I always work really hard to have recipes that are for your real life. That doesn't mean ultra easy. It means some are ultra easy. Some are a little bit more involved, but for times when you need a little bit more involved, like if you're hosting something nice and you want something more upscale, like I never try to say that all my recipes are easy, because some are not. I mean, most are, I think you would say, right?
Vast,
As
vast, vast majority are. I will say here's the way that I would define how your recipes are different. 'Cause like I have there's the two cookbooks that I cook out of the most are well, and I okay, in my head, real life kosher cooking and more real life kosher cooking are one book, even though I know that that's not technically accurate. But like the people who I cook from the most, I would say there's three people actually. It's yours. I cook a lot from Danielle Renoff's book. I love her book. And I cook a lot from, it started out as an Instagram account. She just came out with a cookbook. It's called Yummy Toddler Food, because that's the stage that I am at in my life. And her cookbook is actually the only, like, not specifically kosher cookbook that I have. It's called Dinner Time SOS. And whatever, I just, basically, it's just anytime that there's meat and cheese in a recipe, I leave the cheese out. And that's a great book also. And I would say that the main difference for me, like the way that I think about those three books in my head, Danielle's recipes are delicious, usually a little bit more involved, which sometimes I'm in the mood for that. And always like when I'm in the mood for something exotic, because she's Moroccan and I am very Ashkenaz, and anything right. with cumin in it is automatically exotic. So that's where like Danielle lives, and your recipes live in, oh shoot, we have to eat tonight. Okay, what are we making? And that's when I go to your recipes. It's like, oh, right. Yeah, Shabbos happens. This is, you know, cut to me Friday morning at 10 a.m. going like, well, I guess I got to go grocery shopping. That's when I pull out your books. And you, I would say, are most often in my supper rotation. Because again, like they just come together really fascinating to get things on the table quickly. And that's where the real life aspect of it comes in. I want to pause for 1 second because we have not clearly defined what Pesach food is for someone who doesn't know. Pesach is Passover, obviously. Right. And we don't eat chametz, which is basically grains. So you've, what is it? It's barley, rye, oat, wheat, and spelt that you don't eat unless it's in matzah, pretty much. See, Pesach right. of education. I can still, you know, rattle things off.
Very impressive. Yes.
Thank you. Browse. That's the way you remember that. Barley, rye, oat, wheat, and spelt.
Oh. I mean,
I didn't know that.
I don't think I could have rattled off the grains.
My sixth grade teacher had that mnemonic for browse, and that's what the only reason why I remember it. But it also, you know, the recipes are basically gluten-free. That's basically what we're talking about. We're talking about gluten-free cooking.
Right. So there are people on Pesach who eat what we call gebraks, which is you basically grind up matzahs into almost a flour and cook with that. So I do not, my in-laws eat gebraks. I did not grow up eating gebraks. So in fact, when I started writing the cookbook, a friend reached out to me and she's like, you know, you should put a bunch of gebraks recipes in. Everybody's trying to write non-gebraks Pesach recipes, and there's nothing for us people who eat gebraks.
She's got a point.
You're probably right, but I didn't grow up cooking this way. And I don't know how to cook gebraks. Like, I mean, could I try? Yeah. But do I think at this point when we have such good, you know, almond flour is such a game changer, and there's all kinds of, you know, there's coconut flour and tapioca starch, and there's so many things you could use. And matzah meal is really heavy, and everything, right. especially if you're using shmur matzah meal, which for those who don't know what that means, it means,
it's just extra matzah-y.
Like hand heavy matzah. Right. And they're...
I didn't know that they make shmura matzah meal. I didn't know that was a thing.
Well, so for... Did you grow up eating gebraks?
No.
Oh, okay. So you probably ate gebraks on the last day of Pesach though, right?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly how I grew up. We didn't eat gebraks, but we ate on the last day. And my husband also doesn't do gebraks. So okay. My sister's all married guys who do gebraks, but... No matzah pizza for me.
So I actually went from like very, very, very restrictive Pesach customs to like very not restrictive, which we'll talk about in a minute because it's an interesting, you know, trying to balance both.
Mm-hmm.
But for the last day of Pesach, when my parents ate gebraks, my father had a special little mini food processor that was like only for the matzah. I don't think for like keeping the matzah separate, just because it, like the matzah like killed regular food processors. So he like had, I think, like a spice grinder, and he took matzah and made matzah meal out of it. And it was,
oh, wow.
You would make like a cup and we would make like one thing, and it was never that good. And so I was like, I did not have a pull to put gebraks in. So the interesting thing is that the whole book is non-gebraks, AKA gluten-free. There are two recipes that can be gebraks or not gebraks.
Oh, like there's a variation.
And yeah. So I almost left them out. Because I wanted to just say the whole book is non-gebraks. And I was like, no, there's such great recipes. Like, I can't. One is matzo ball sliders with pulled beef. So you actually make a matzo ball. You bake it. You cut it in half and bake it. And then it makes a little slider bun. And you serve it with pulled beef and whatever other toppings. And they are so cute. And they sell non-gebraks knedel mix. That's what it will say on the box, which is basically made from potatoes, but we use that in my house, and my siblings have used that for years, and it works really well. I actually was nervous that it wouldn't, but I tried it and I was like, ooh, I like this better. So it, you know, so there's that one. And then the other one is like a family heirloom kind of recipe. My father makes every year on the last day of Pesach. This was the only Gebraks food that we really liked. My father always makes a veal pocket with a matzah stuffing.
Yum.
And it was always amazing and phenomenal. So I was like, I can't not include that. So I have those two recipes, but I do give a non-Gebraks variation.
What is the non-Gebraks variation for the stuffing?
Should I say? Should it be a surprise? There's a homemade cracker recipe.
I saw that cracker. You showed me the picture of that cracker, and it looks
Oh, yeah.
so good.
Yeah.
Oh, and I could see that being working
Yeah.
really well in a
So,
stuffing.
yeah. So that recipe, I was just like, there's no way I'm leaving it out. But anyway, I want to talk about the cup. I think that was probably the one of the hardest part, not hardest, but one of the parts that of the writing this cookbook that like I really, really struggled with was figuring out how to balance different Passover customs. So here's what I mean. I write recipes for Mishpacha magazine, and Mishpacha likes to have a couple of, like a bunch of recipes every year that use like no products. Just to explain for people who, because it's interesting when I talk about this, people who don't have strict Passover customs always get very confused. So just to clarify, there are different customs, often depending on where you came from, like where your family originated from and other things. Some people, as long as it's kosher for Passover, they'll eat it. Others don't use any products. Like that's the opposite end of
And when
the
you say
spectrum.
product, you're
Like
talking about something that's
everything.
pre-made. So, for example, they would
Yeah.
like make their own ketchup. They would buy tomatoes and make ketchup as
Right.
opposed to
So
buying a
there is
bottle of ketchup.
actually a recipe in real life Pesach cooking for homemade ketchup, starting with tomatoes. But that's like the middle ground. But there are people who won't even use potato starch and sugar and stuff like that. So obviously,
If you're not
I
using
don't have a
potato starch,
whole.
what are you using? Like you're starting with potatoes and making your own potato starch?
Well, you could, but
Or you're just not
I wouldn't
baking?
bother. I it could be. I don't know. Thankfully, that's never been an issue for me.
Right.
So my parents' customs fell closer to that side of the spectrum. So they use basic products, which definitely is something a lot of people do, like very basic products. So like, you know, the sugar and the potato starch and the cocoa powder and kind of single ingredient things as opposed to like prepared things. So things like crackers or I don't know. I'm drawing a
Would you,
blank, but
growing up, would you buy ketchup or would you make it?
so interestingly, my father allowed ketchup for the kids.
Oh, interesting. I've heard a lot of people who like have stuff like that they do just for the kids.
So we had ketchup, but like I feel like we didn't grow up as like major ketchup people. It's funny because you know now my husband and I are both like really
How
don't
could you
like
not be a
ketchup.
ketchup person?
I had to buy it for like the one recipe that has ketchup in it. I like bought ketchup. Although
That's okay.
I will say, by the way, interestingly, another thing that, you know, on the topic of Pesach customs, there's a whole thing we didn't discuss is like the concept of kitnios, which is basically legumes. So
Sure.
Sfardim eat legumes on Pesach, and Ashkenazim generally don't. And so I don't have any recipes with kitnios, legumes, but that actually, in a way, was much harder to work with than not having wheat. And I'll tell you what I mean. Soy sauce is kitnios.
Right.
Mustard is kitnios. Those are like my two go-tos for flavor. And I
Right.
was like, hey, so many recipes. I was like, all this needs is like a little bit of mustard.
Well, they do make a not, I don't know what the heck it's made out of, but there is
So
a Pesach mustard.
yeah, so
What is it?
I don't, I'm not sure. My guess is there's turmeric for color. I'm not sure what they use, like probably vinegar. It's not good. I don't like
Right.
them. And so I don't use any of that artificial stuff, no artificial soy sauce, no artificial mustard. I don't. And I know when I told people that, they were really excited. They were like, oh, good. Like this is, 'cause you know, it's kind of a little bit of a cop out. Like, sure, you could just make your regular food and just substitute these artificial garbage, but I wanted food that was of better quality. But the other thing that's very hard is not using corn and corn products, right? It
Right.
happens to be I love corn in like every form. Like popcorn is my favorite food. I always say that. I love cornmeal, like baking like cornbread and things. I love corn on the cob. I even in the winter when the corn is not as good, I still buy corn on the cob. I grill it, I cut it off, and I put it in like at least one or two salads a week. Like we love corn in this house. So not using that was hard. But the interesting thing this whole tangent started was because I wanted to point out that Pesach ketchup does not have corn syrup, which year-round ketchup very much has. So people actually like to stock up on it. A little tip if you're not into corn syrup in your food. Obviously, Pesach ketchup cannot have corn syrup if, you know, because mainstream kosher Pesach products all have no kidneys.
Right, it's just simpler
But we
to cater
love
to that
the
most restrictive thing. People do the same thing with Coke. Also, Pesach Coke is different because
recipe.
of the lack of corn
Pesach
syrup.
Coke, that's a very good point. It's made with sugar instead of corn syrup. And people who, you know, like in the olden days, before olden days,
In the
like
early 2000s.
art, no, much longer ago, like in this a long time ago when they switched from sugar to corn syrup
Right.
at
Oh,
Coke.
that's you're talking about the olden Coke days. Yes, like in yes, the
Yeah.
1900s,
No,
as
I
they
know.
say.
When I say olden days, I'm like, oh God, little kids call our child olden days.
So have you seen this meme where like a kid says to their mom, like, "Wow, Ma, you were born in the 1900s."
I know, it makes me feel so old. And it wasn't even
Proudly.
like, what?
I'm proudly born in the 1900s. Makes it sound like I grew up on a stagecoach.
I did one time, I was talking to my friend's kid. I was probably like 8 or 9 at the time. And I was telling him how before GPSs, when we traveled, you would take out like a paper map. So I explained that like sometimes if you didn't know where you were going, you would like pull over to the side of the road and like look at the paper map to figure out where to go. And he's, I'm not sure if he was joking or not. I think he was like 70% joking. He said, and while you were pulled over, the horses escaped.
If you really wanted to blow his mind, you could tell him about MapQuest. I remember as a kid, like when we went on long drives, my dad would be driving and my
Would
mom
print it
would be
out.
holding the MapQuest printout. And then
Yeah,
if
but
you,
before MapQuest, I'm
you're talking
older than
about
you. Maybe
pre-MapQuest.
your memories don't like. Do you remember like cars with the roll-up windows
I
and?
don't. I don't. You
Oh,
like the couple of years that you have on me are important years when it comes to that kind of stuff. I was
yeah.
born in '94.
Oh, yeah. I'm a few years older. I was born in '88.
Okay.
You know, people on Instagram are obsessed with my age.
Are they
It's so
really?
weird. Like every time I do a Q&A, they're like, how old are you? And then one time someone's like, why are you shy about your age? And I was like, I was born at 5:11 p.m. on July 6, 1988. Is that specific enough? Like, I'm not shy about my age.
It's funny because what I also find now is that a lot of the people who I'm close with are a couple years older than me.
You're
It's just
mature.
maybe, I think it
You
also
know, I
just
always
has.
tell my husband, especially when it comes to like financial stuff, because I suck at all that. I tell him, I'm just a baby.
I think that it's also just because of the work that I do. Like a lot of the people who are in this field tend to be a little bit older. I started when I was 21 and everyone around me was like, I don't know, like in their mid to late 20s. And now it's a couple of years later and I'm in my late 20s and they're in their 30s. Like it's just the
So when
way.
I started as a food blogger in 2011, I can't do math right now, but I was born in 1988, so figure it out. It
Not that
wasn't
far
that
off.
I was in my low 20s, and I was like the little kid. And everybody else around me was like older. Even like Chani and Melinda, Bezerra
Sure.
Brooklyn and Melinda Strauss, they started about 6 months before me, but they're both like maybe 5, 6 years older. I should be revealing people's ages
I don't think that it's like it's that's not a secret, I don't think. They're not like
They're a few years older. I mean, they have big kids and
Right.
whatever. But now it feels like we're the same age. But back then, those few
Well,
years
there's also that
felt so
phenomenon where,
quick.
like, when you're little, like the difference between a 6 month
Right.
old and a year and a half year old is galaxies apart. The difference between
Right.
someone who's 20 and someone who's 21 and a half, there is no difference,
Right.
you
No
know? And
difference.
even less so between someone who's 30 and someone who's 40. It's like
Right. Right.
you're in
Right.
like
Like
that
that's what I'm
same
saying
stage.
now. We're in the same stage in life. It's not, it's like I'm the exact same age as them. But
Right.
when I was in my low 20s and, you know, young, single, whatever, and they were both like married with kids, it definitely, it felt like they were like, you know, older. But now there's a whole new crop of people. You know, it's been, we're like the bubbies of the industry, of
Right.
the cooking food blogging industry. And now there's like all these young people. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so old. You were in like elementary school when I started my
I
blog.
graduated high school in 2013.
Oh, so you were in high school
I
when
was
I
in high school
started.
when you started. Yeah, I graduated in 2013. But that's like really interesting to think about how like kosher food blogging has changed over the past, 12 years that you've been doing it. What do you think is the biggest difference between when you started and now?
Oh my God, what was similar? I okay, so social media has changed everything. When I started my blog, people had websites and only like social media was like a very side part of it. Like I met Chani and Melinda and a few others who were around, Leah Shapira, who had a different website, Not Between Carpels. She had Cook Kosher back then. Who else did I meet back then? There's I'm very sorry to whoever I'm forgetting, but there was definitely a good handful of people. A lot of them are no longer active in this industry, and some of them are still in different forms or whatever. But everybody had websites, and I think I'm one of the few who like still actively updates my website. And the truth is, ooh, I'm gonna reveal something here. So I probably will talk about this on Instagram at some point. Maybe before this gets published. Maybe not. I don't know. But I'm actually really trying to change my focus away from social media. Not that I won't still be active on social media, but really all my recipes are going on my website. And the reason is very simple. I have ads on my website, and so you get a free recipe. I get paid for you to get that free recipe, and it's just such a win-win. And I just, it's such a better way to work with like the way I my business is than doing all this extra sponsored stuff or whatever it is, because at the end of the day, what I love doing is making recipes for people. It's the reason I've written four cookbooks, because like I can't stop. Like that's what I love to do. And so yeah, I can get paid to do a promo of an item or a whatever on, and I could get paid to do other things, but like this is what I love doing. And so I don't know if you signed up for my emails.
I am.
Oh, okay. So I that this is like that's the first big shift that I did, is that I made it a huge priority that every single week, no matter what, except this past week when my website was down, which was really not fun. That's a whole separate story. But I publish an email that people are loving. Like Baruch Hashem, I'm so grateful that people enjoy it. And I really think not like, what do I want you to see on my blog, but rather, what will you want to see on my blog? And so I share a weekly menu plan. And wow, I'm going such a tangent. Oh my
No, I
gosh, I
love this.
have to.
I'm so this
So
idea of not publishing the recipe directly on Instagram is something that's very common in the not kosher world. If you
right.
if you're looking at not
So
kosher food
I can
bloggers,
elaborate.
yeah,
How
please do, because
many
I
of
see
them
very
want to?
often from not kosher
Cool.
bloggers, the recipe is very rarely in the caption. It's always find the link in my bio, and then you find the recipe and you
Right.
go and you save the page there.
So I'll elaborate on this a little bit. The first thing I want to say is that I really rarely, even in the past couple of years, when I kind of, was focusing on Instagram maybe more than my website, I still tried not to publish my new recipes on Instagram. I tried to do it on my website. It's a lot more work, which is really the reality of every time a recipe is published on my Instagram. It's because I didn't have time to do a whole post on my blog. But the thing is, so one very big thing is having ad income from you viewing my recipe is huge, because I don't need to do as much sponsored stuff. I can just get paid to give you free content. Like that is the ultimate win-win, like I said. But there's a few other things. So, and this is something, I know people have mixed feelings. Like I get people telling me both ways. So some people are like, oh, I hate having to click a link. I'd rather just screenshot it off of Instagram. But on the other
Ew.
hand, there are so many benefits to having it on a website. One of them is that you have a search option. So you go to my website, you want a chicken dinner, you want a chicken recipe to make for dinner, type the word chicken into the search bar, and you'll come up with a whole lot of options. You don't have that on Instagram. But then the other thing is that when you find the recipe you want to make, so you find the chicken recipe that you want to make and you click on the thing, you can save it on your computer, but there's also a printer-friendly option that prints like a recipe card. And that's huge because on Instagram, like screenshotting, it's
It's
not
the worst.
right. And
It's the
so
worst. And also,
I.
personal pet peeve, because mostly everything on Instagram now is video and the videos loop. That means that if you are cooking from a caption, the person, I love your voice dearly, Miriam, but after I've heard the recipe 10 times over, it's enough. And
I
it.
could not agree more. Like, it's so not ideal. And it is more work for me. But like I said, I get paid for that. So, one, I'm
Can
really
I be
stressing.
rude and ask, how does the ad income compare to like a sponsored post? Type income, could it replace it completely?
In theory, that's what I'd love to do. Right
Okay.
now, I'm not posting as much. Like, I haven't over the last year posted as much. But I would love to like completely do away with sponsored stuff and just have ads. And even if
Because the
some of
thing
the
that
ads
people
can
don't
be open.
realize is that that sponsored content takes a lot of work to produce. That's
Right,
not, you know,
right. And
that's
it's
extra work that you're doing.
right. And but going back to the website versus Instagram thing, I do get people saying like, oh, I hate that you have to click a link. But overall, most people are like, wow, I really appreciate that. It's so much easier not to have to be dealing with this on Instagram. It's just not ideal. And I'm people sometimes are like, do you like hold back your like tip things like that you don't want to tell other people about? And I'm like, no, whatever I know, I share. Like, that's the way I've always been. And I actually, a bunch of my friends on Instagram know. I'm always telling them, like, when they post these great recipes, I'm like, put it on a website, get yourself a website, put it there, get ads. You're not being paid for making recipes on Instagram. You might be paid for other things on Instagram, but why not get paid for these recipes? So
Yeah, no, you're
that's
absolutely right. The
side.
other big thing there that I've seen a lot of people talk about is this idea that if something happened to Instagram tomorrow, and there have been times when Instagram has been down for, you know, 24 hours or whatever, then your recipes are gone. You know, if your account gets shut down, your recipes are gone. If if there's like a mass reporting thing, your account gets shut down. If there's a war going on and people want to spend less time on Instagram because it's really depressing, your account for all intents and purposes gets shut down. Like you lose those
That's
eyeballs.
so big. And I was preaching this for so long, and I kind of gave up because people just follow the trends, and I've never been a trend follower. I always just do my own thing. But the truth is that we're like going in a whole different direction here.
No, this
Wow.
is
But
fascinating. I love
the
this.
truth is that I cannot tell you how strongly I feel. Even if you don't want a website, you need to get your Instagram followers to at least an email sign
Right,
up.
somewhere else.
You cannot put your entire business in the hands of Mark Zuckerberg. That is crazy. Like, you know, whatever it is, whether your account gets hacked and you can't get it back, whether, even though I think people with big accounts take a lot of precautions, which if you want to go into a tangent of a tangent of a tangent,
Put on two-factor authentication, people.
yes. But also, by the way, I don't click on links
As you should
in my
not.
DMs, even if it's a friend. I don't click on links because a good friend of mine got hacked. It happens to be very spammy looking, so I wasn't really at risk of clicking it. But I said, you know what? I don't click on links in DMs. If someone sends me a link, I will that I'm curious about, like sometimes I'll copy it, paste it, and go
A browser.
to a browser, like off of Instagram, but I will not click on links. So yeah, don't get yourself hacked. But there's other things, you know, the algorithm shifts, and it's like you're a slave to that, and I don't want to be a slave to that. So, but you shouldn't be. If you have, you know, if it's a hobby or a side hustle, it's one thing. But if this is your entire business and you don't have something that you own, you really have to rethink your business, because
Yeah, it's
that's very,
borrowed time.
very
It's borrowed
expensive.
time and it's borrowed space. I want to ask you one more question about this, and then we'll go back to talking about Pesach cooking. You mentioned the algorithm. I have a personal pet peeve, which is when people basically talk about the algorithm, which is ironic considering what I'm about to do. But the I find that in general, and like we know this in principle to be true, that Instagram just wants you, Mark Zuckerberg wants you spending as much time as possible on Instagram, right? That's where they want you spending your time. So the approach that I've always had is if you put out good stuff, people will want to see it and the algorithm will kind of figure it out. Like I kind of like the algorithms because it gets my stuff in front of the right people. And then it puts a lot of the control in my hands with, I need to put out good stuff. And if I'm putting out quality content, then the right people see it. And I find that a lot of the times when people are just fetching about the algorithm, they're using it as an excuse for poor content that nobody really wants to see anyways.
I think that is very, very true. I don't want to say it's always the case because there have been times when I put out like the best content and my views tank. And it's so weird. It's like lately, I think since the war started, I could have days where my views are so high. I'm like, oh my God, what is happening? And then I have days where my views are so low that I'm like, I'm done with this. And I think that's part of why I really made this shift, because I was like, I can't, this roller coaster of like, today lots of people see my stuff and tomorrow, you know, with my list, I have not as many people on as I do on Instagram. I have a little over 20,000 people, and about half of them open the email, which you probably know is
that's amazing. Good.
Yeah.
For reference, people, 20% is considered a phenomenal open rate for these types of things.
And by the way, my click-through rate is like 10%, which is like,
wow,
like 2%, right?
Wow. So, from a 50%. Wow. Okay. So for reference, 20% is considered like a phenomenal open rate, and like 2% is considered an amazing click rate. So yeah. But again, I think that just speaks to the fact that the right people are seeing things that are actually helpful to them.
Right. Right. But you know what? It doesn't vary from week to week. It's just people who want my emails, get them and open them and whatever. But 100%, I think, and I also think when people like complain too much about the algorithm and like, oh, they're not showing my content to people, like, listen, they're in the business to make money. So if they want, you know, they're not here to make you make money. They're here to make money themselves.
That's not their job. So there's also this level of like, especially like you mentioned, since the war, right? Views have tanked because people are spending less time online. I know for myself that like, because a lot of the accounts that I follow personally, and I've said this 100 times already, I think that if you have a majority Jewish audience, you have a responsibility to not be sharing pictures of beheaded babies, but that's just me. And because the online space has become that much more toxic since the war, people, especially Jewish consumers who are our main audiences, are spending less time online, and that's going to affect your views. And so having an email list, like a way that you can reach people outside of, you know, all the other garbage that happens online, is so, so, so valuable. I know that you are holding the book, and I want to see, I've seen the pictures. I want to see it.
Okay. Shame that we can't show your audience.
I'll post a picture with the, you know, it'll be, I'll link the picture in the show notes. It's really nice. Love this letterboard idea. I think that that's just so like nice.
I came up with it. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, let me find others who did it so I could see how they did it.
And there were none.
And searched. I literally could not find one cookbook with a letterboard. And I was like, I'm going to do it. But the interesting thing is, so when I talked a little bit about this on Instagram, and people got the wrong idea. It was so funny. I said, like, you know, I had to get the idea approved by art. Like, I had to get the cover approved by Arts Girl. And someone was like, what wouldn't they approve? And I was like, no. We're not talking about things that aren't like from enough for them. It's that they have to, you know, they at the end of the day probably sell more kosher cookbooks than any other publisher in the world, because they're the top kosher Jewish, they're the top Orthodox publisher, and for kosher cookbooks they're the absolute top, and so they know how to market and sell these books. And you know, Rabbi Meir Lotowitz, who founded Art Scroll, he used to say, anyone who says that you shouldn't judge a book by its cover never tried to sell one.
He's right. He is absolutely right.
There's so much that goes into it. You know, I very much respect their expertise and opinions. So I wanted to get the idea approved by them. What I did was I shot like a fake version of it. And then I sent it to the graphic artist at Art Scroll, and I said, can you make like a quick mock-up just so they can actually see what it would look like? So the cover, I guess I'll try to describe it for people listening, but there's a letterboard that says Real Life Pesach Cooking, and then there's the subtitle and my name, and then there's like a utensil bin and some like a little pretty oil jug, and then some flowers, and then in like the front there's like a brisket. So it didn't have the brisket. The flowers were actually the same because we did it like 2 days later. But it actually looked really similar to the way it came out. But it was like covers are very stressful because again, you say don't judge a book by its cover, but like people do very much judge a book by its cover. And so they the right message and the right look, like it's so much thought goes into it. And it was actually the first cover that I went into with such a strong concept and an idea. My other covers, I went into it, I was like kind of like, okay, I'm gonna figure it out. And here I had such a strong idea and such a defined idea that it was actually like so easy. And I like then when the I mean we worked very hard. For example, the letters Real Life Pesach Cooking are not actually on the letterboard. They were done on the computer, but she used the Aviva at Art School. She's incredible. So she used the letterboard font, and I guess she doesn't have any letterboard, so she didn't know that the letters on a letterboard, there's on the bottom, there's like a little peg kind of thing that makes it into the lines. Well, I could see in the background that you have a letterboard, so you know. But so she didn't know it's on the bottom, not the top. So she had aligned it on the top, and I was like, oh no, you have to align it on the bottom. So she aligned it on the bottom, and then we like obsessed over the shadows to make sure that they really match exactly, like from where the light in the picture is coming from and how deep they should be. And then this you won't be able to see, but these are raised,
Oh,
like I
that's
think
cool.
embossed. Yeah, so it's like textured here, which is so
Oh,
nice.
that's nice.
Yeah, and then also on the spine, it's also like textured. So anyway, that was like such a huge thing. But anyway, so then like she designed, we completed the design, and I actually sat with her while we could, like the end when we were finishing everything, and then she like sent it off to Rabbi Gedalia Zlotowicz to get it approved, and he approved it. And I was like, wait, what? Like that's it? Like right away, he's like, perfect. And I was
Yeah,
like, wait,
it's good. It's
what?
great.
What? Like, where's people picking it apart and saying they hate it? Like, how is it possible that we're done already?
It's a really gorgeous cover. It's a really gorgeous cover. It's a really gorgeous book.
Also, I want to say the background, like this like backsplash that you see. So the counter, and I hope I'm not like giving like too much detail that people like
I'm
shouldn't know.
interested.
I'm an open book. So this is a vinyl backsplash. And this is a
Right.
vinyl like just whatever. So the counter. It's propped up on the table. It was a little too low for what I needed. So I raised it up like a few inches. And then this, my friend actually made the tile backsplash. It's not vinyl, it's actual real tile that my friend made for me. She went to Home Depot and she got a huge like 2x4
2x4 and 2x8 are like
wood.
your
Yeah, I think
standards.
2x4 maybe. I think it was 2 feet high and 4 feet wide. And she actually glued all the tiles on. And we used it throughout the book as well, including here. I'm opening the book to show you. Look, isn't this
Oh, that's
nice?
nice. It's the inside of the cover.
Yeah, so this is called the end leaf. And so we used the tile there, and then we put the little letterboard that says from the kitchen off, so you could put your name there.
I love that. It is such a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous book. I cannot wait to get it into my
So
Pesach
much.
kitchen that doesn't exist and that I will not cook for Pesach for, but that I will just tell my mother what
Well, you
recipe
know
she
what? I
should make
want to
from it.
say that people who are not cooking for Pesach will still want this book because there are so many recipes, so many recipes that you will make like all the time, like every Shabbos. I mean, I make a ton of recipes from this all the time. They're just really good basic recipes. If you have a family member or friends who are gluten-free that you cook for sure you need it because there's all kinds of amazing gluten-free recipes. But really there's just so many things that you'll make all year round, like oh, pesto steak salad, I think I'm making for Shabbos.
Yum.
So yeah, it is
Yum.
quite
That
yum.
sounds delicious. I hate that I have to
Garden
cut us
salad.
off, but I do have to cut us off. And I want to, first of all,
Oh.
if somebody wants to learn more about you, get the book, get their feet wet when it comes to Pesach cooking, where are they going?
Okay, so obviously overtimecook.com, like we said. You can also sign up for those emails that are very popular. There's a link all over my website. There's links to sign up for that. Obviously on Instagram, overtimecook. There's also overtimecook on Facebook. And then if I can give a little plug to my podcast, which is really my husband's podcast. I know, Rifki, I know you really enjoyed it, which we're very grateful for. It is very not related to food. It's a Parsha podcast. My husband is a teacher and he teaches a Parsha, but unlike just Torah class where you just listen, both of us. So he's teaching me, and it's a dialogue between us. And what people said is it feels like they're sitting at a Shabbos table with us, and it's just a great conversation, which I love because that's exactly what we're going for. So you can find that. It's called Toras Chaim, which means instructions for living. And we are on, Apple Podcasts, Spotify.
And I'm going to link that in the show notes. Wherever you're listening to this, you can search for that and find it.
And you can spend Pesach with me at the Armon Hotel in Stamford, Connecticut. I will be doing demos, and my husband is going to be speaking, and we are going to be there as well. So,
Awesome. Oh, so fun.
yes.
And all of that will be in the show notes as well so that you can access
So
it
much for
and
having
get all
me,
that
Rafi.
information. My pleasure, but I'm not letting you go just yet because I want to know from you, where in your life do you think you've had the most impact?
Oh, that's a very good question. I would have said that people all around the world cooking my recipes and enhancing their lives through my recipes is a huge impact and probably the biggest, and maybe it still is the biggest. But our last podcast that we recorded just about a year ago, I opened the door to talk about weight and body shaming in the Orthodox community and in life in general. And I've seen a lot of real world implications from that. And it was such a hard thing for me to do. I exposed my inner insecurities more than I ever thought I would in such a public manner. But the positive change that has brought is just so meaningful to me, and I'm really proud that not of myself specifically, but of my community, because it was the fact that everybody exposed their inner insecurities and their pain also, and worked with me to do this. And it was just, I'm like humbled that I was able to do that. And I do think that, I in terms of numbers, maybe it's not the biggest impact, but in terms of that one kid whose mother said that their overweight kid, they're struggling with an overweight kid, and they now know what not to do. Like, that is a life changer for that kid forever. So, obviously more than one kid, but I'm saying it really
That's
changes
really
lives.
special. And
And
that is still one of the episodes that I get the most. People will listen to it and then they'll reach out. Like, wow, that was really important and really interesting to listen to. So thank you for doing that one and
thank
this
you so
one.
much for
And
having me.
thank you for
I
being
always love
on.
chatting with you.
And it's always a good fun time. Have a good one.
You too.
By the way, my Pesach plans have changed and I am hosting for a portion of it. And I'm not even freaked out because I have real life Pesach cooking in my back pocket. So thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Miriam, her links are in the show notes. On last week's episode, I spoke with jewelry designer Rachie Schnee. Listen to it wherever you're hearing this one. The Be Impactful podcast is a project of Impact Fashion, the clothing line I created because I believe that we are all deserving of the beautiful things life has to offer. See my modest designs that are available in sizes 2 through 28 by going to impactfashionnyc.com. Access all of that by swiping up on the cover art. There are currently 18 people listed by Or Agunot as a recalcitrant party. View their names, photos, locations, and details of their cases by visiting getor.org/recalcitrant-parties. The episode art was designed by Michelle Moses, original music composed by Nissan Fatman. This episode was produced and hosted by me, Rifki Itzkowitz. Catch me on all the socials at impact.fashion.nyc. Here's to making impact together. You've spent quite a bit of time listening to me, and now it's my turn to listen to you. By just answering a few questions in a short listener survey, you can share feedback about show content you'd like to see in the future and help me shape Be Impactful into the best showcase of female voices out there. Even better, once you've completed the survey, you'll receive an exclusive code to shop at impactfashionnyc.com as my thanks. The survey is short and sweet and will help me keep bringing you content you love. Just go to impactfashionnyc.com/survey. Again, that's impactfashionnyc.com/survey, and thank you so much in advance.